irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Get Yourself the Job with Jennifer Hill, only on LA Talk Radio.
Well, happy Monday, everybody, and happy holidays to all of you out there in the world, wherever you might be celebrating it. Today, we are excited to have with us Mark Miller. Mark's career has spanned over 22 years, including IBM, thriving tech startups, and a stint as a high school math teacher, as well as a gig raising funds for the Jewish Community Center and a near-fatal bike accident that changed his perspective forever. 30 years of wandering and the proverbial career desert taught Mark his most crucial lesson. Most people don't really know what makes them happy at their core, what fulfills them. They pursue money, status, a skill set, all of which provide some level of satisfaction, but not contentment. Mark founded CareerPivot.com to help people transition their careers to create successful and fulfilling professional lives. Mark, thanks so much for joining us today and talking to us a little bit about your Career Pivot website and how we out there in the world can make pivots in our careers.
Well, it's great to be with you.
Yes, thank you so much. So this is such a fascinating story. Please tell us a little bit about how you jumped around to some of these different careers, from fundraising for the Jewish Community Center to the fatal bike accident that changed your perspective. How did that all come about?
Well, I started out like most baby boomers. I was told when I graduated from college to go work for a father-like company that would take care of me. And I went to work for IBM. And if you go back to the late 70s and 80s, most of the big companies wanted generalists. They wanted us to move around. And so I did that. And because I am what you probably call a multi-potentialite, I have lots of interests and I get bored every 3 years. So I moved around a lot in my career. And then as the 90s hit and things became much more dangerous, I joke, I went from being an engineer to being into sales. I crossed into the dark side. I became a full-time professional speaker for IBM. And then in 1999, they screwed me on my pension. They converted us all to a cash balance plan and they converted us back. And I said, bye. Goodbye. And so after 22 years, I'd had enough. I took the lump sum money. It turned out one of the smartest financial moves I ever made. And I went to work for a successful startup that, by the way, that was acquired by Lucent. And I joke, you know, if IBM was the Borg, Lucent was the sister of the Borg. they were a huge monolithic company. And then on July 11th of 2002, I'm a big time cyclist. I was riding with my bike club. I came down a hill. At about 25 miles an hour, I turned into a blind turn where the road was cambered the wrong way, so I couldn't hold the turn, and I slammed into a Toyota Corolla going about 25 miles an hour head on.
Oh, my God.
And I totaled the car with my body and my bicycle. I spent 5 days in the Breckenridge Trauma Center. I tore up a knee, I broke a hip, I dislocated a shoulder, broke a bunch of ribs, broke the clavicle, had imprints of the pads of the helmet in my head, but I had no internal injuries and no brain injuries I'm willing to admit to. And they had me walking on crutches in 3 days. I was back on a bike in 10 weeks, and I was flying back to China in 4 months. Oh, by the way, I flew right smack into Guangdong province in the middle of the SARS epidemic.
Oh, no.
It's what I refer to as my WTF moment. Why am I doing this? At those speeds, you have about a 10% survival rate. All things considered, I was not badly hurt. So I decided, okay, I'm going to lay myself off the next year. And I decided I was going to go get my math teaching certificate. Now, I've taught adults for about 20 plus years at that point in 40 different countries. So I said, I'm going to go do this. And I got my math teaching certificate from the local community college, and I taught high school for 2 years in an inner city high school. I left after 2 years because I couldn't do that and stay healthy. I quote, I conned myself into believing I was an extrovert.
Mm.
I'm really a closet introvert. And I ended up after 2 years just exhausted. And I left there and I'm going, okay, what the heck do I do now? My first startup left us debt free, didn't leave us rich. But at 46, I was debt free. My son was out of the house. His college was funded. And I could pretty much do whatever I wanted. And that's when I went off to look for nonprofit work. And I ended up landing at the Jewish Community Center as developing a corporate development program. As I joke, being a non-Jew, being the face of a Jewish organization is interesting. I grew up in an entirely Jewish neighborhood in New Jersey. I mean, we used to get Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur off of school holidays. So, you know, I did that for a year, realized that wasn't going to work. And I, quote, I relapsed, and I went back into another tech startup, a high-definition video conferencing startup, where I once again was building training and certification programs for around the world. And so during that time, I was watching so many of my friends get wiped out in the dot-com boom bust. And then later, I've been on a board of a nonprofit Launchpad Job Club for 10 years that serves largely, we've served almost 20,000 people in the last 15 years. And I was watching our numbers grow in the middle of the Great Recession to 400 people a week, largely baby boomers, and nobody was doing anything. The assumption was we were all going to go off and ride off into the sunset and retire. Reality is 80% of us don't have the money to retire. So that is a huge paradigm shift. And at the time, I started looking for books and who was worried about what's going to happen to all these baby boomers. And I basically found almost nothing. Even if you look at organizations like Encore.org, which has a wonderful mission, it says we're all going to retire and go do volunteer work and work for nonprofits.
Hmm.
Nope. So I started Career Pivot because almost all my career transitions, and I've had many, have all been what I refer to as half-step career changes, i.e. I always had one foot in the old world, I had one foot in the new world, and there was always a relationship that took me across. In other words, I never made these huge leaps from being a technical person to being a pastry chef. Right? There are logical, and we came up with the term pivot because there are logical steps that you can make as you move along. And that's why my book, Repurpose Your Career, is all about taking these incremental steps. And most of the time it's you and your profession, you're usually branded in two ways. You're branded by either your business acumen, which in my case has for the longest time has been in learning and development, and your industry skills. The reality is you usually can only change one of those. And I've got lots of examples where I've taken people through step by step where they move out of within the same industry into a new job, and then they move from that job into a new industry. And it's kind of making these incremental steps. Because most of us, when we reach our 50s and 60s, we can't afford to take huge risks. True. We still have mortgages to pay. We still got kids to put through college.
How did you come up with a way to do both then? It sounds like what you're saying is a lot of people do one or the other, but it sounds like
most of the time, even when I came out of learning development into launching Career Pivot, largely what I do now is still learning and development, but in a different industry. Now, I'll use the example, my my 53-year-old intern, Elizabeth Rabe, who's been on my podcast. What I did with her was she had been in environmental engineering doing air and water permitting for 20 plus years. So within the same industry, actually within the same firm, we moved her into a business development and marketing role. Then we have since moved her out into a peer marketing role, and she now works for a international mining equipment company. By the way, the joke is, if you have big rocks in your yard, she can help you. She got rock crushers.
Oh, my gosh. But
it's because she came out of environmental engineering, they said, well, she understood conveyor belts and rock crushers, never dealt with them. But she moved into a peer marketing role. The next step is to move her into a peer marketing role, completely out of this engineering world. And right now she designs marketing plans for trade shows. She writes blog posts. She does a lot of very creative things, which is a real big leap from doing air and water permitting.
So question, though, you're saying that, so it's great, she's 53 years old, she's made these transitions. Yeah. I'm going to play a devil's advocate with you of what I hear most often on the recruiting end, or if I'm talking to somebody on a plane, and that is, Jennifer, nobody's going to hire me because I'm 53, 63, 73, you name it. And I'm not going to say that I agree with that statement, but I'm curious on your two cents. Have you noticed any pushback from the clients that you represent or from the people you work with respect to their age when they're trying to make a transition into a new field?
I'll put it, if you approach this and say, I'm going to get online, I'm going to apply for a job, and the first time they meet you is through an applicant tracking system or your resume, you have lost. Your next job will come through a relationship. Notice when I said, when I talked about my half-step career changes, there was always a relationship that took me across. Now, it's either going to be a newly created relationship, which, by the way, is the least likely. It's going to be a dormant relationship that you're going to reinvigorate, or an existing relationship. Now, it's those dormant relationships, which I refer to as weak ties, are your actually most valuable ones. People who have known you over the last 20 years. And the term weak tie comes out of a Stanford study back in the 1970s. And what it basically says is people who know you superficially are more valuable to you than the people who know you really well.
Why?
People who know you really... Because the people who know you really well know the same people you do.
Oh, touche. Good point.
Right? So I'm going to give you a couple examples. It may be somebody who you worked with 20 years ago. I had an account manager who he had been laid off. He had worked for the same company for 20 years, selling equipment that packaged food. Okay? And I had him would just methodically reach out to people he had worked with over the last 20 years. And he got hired by a guy he had worked with 15 years earlier who worked for the company that made sensors for that machine that he sold. Okay, so there are those kinds of connections. When I went out to look for teaching high school math, my most valuable connector was my chiropractor. I joke my chiropractor is the other woman in my life. I've been with Michelle since 1992. And she knew a lot of people. Now, if you have kids, one of your most valuable connectors is your kids' friends' parents.
That makes total sense.
Right, because they may live in a total, their network may be totally disconnected from yours. And they know about opportunities and know people that can make introductions. And they know who you are. So it's these loose connections that are actually more valuable. The challenge comes into actually asking for help.
So
now,
true.
I'm a guy. I don't like asking for directions. Okay?
So you and my husband and every other man I know.
Yes, it's genetic. And the point there is, particularly as you make these changes, you're going to have to go suck it up and go ask for help. I'll use the class example. When I went off to teach high school math, I was teaching Algebra 1, Algebra 2 in an inner city high school. I had a wonderful Algebra 1 mentor that was assigned to me, and I was struggling teaching Algebra 2. So I finally, after about 8 weeks, finally sucked it up, and Jenna was across the hallway. She was 27. I was old enough to be her father. I finally went, okay, can I have your lesson plans, please? And what I did was, is I picked up her lesson plans every Friday, and I stayed 2 days behind her. And I stayed 2 days behind her, so if I didn't understand something, I could go down and watch her. And for the rest of the year, I played little puppy dog. I sucked it up. I didn't question. I just did monkey see, monkey do.
It's humbling.
I did it. It's humbling. Because I was coming from a healthy six-figure salary, going to make $39,000 a year. And I was used to being an expert. And I was going, wow, I don't know what the hell I'm doing. And so, the goodness was, is I've taught in so many different countries. One of the things I rapidly figured out was I was dealing with a different culture. I was dealing with a culture of poverty. And that was an invaluable lesson. But like I said, I did that for 2 years and I couldn't, in fact, I've got a chapter in my book, Repurpose Your Career, about the three failures in my career and how I recovered. And that was one of them, because I suffered from what I call MSU syndrome. I made stuff up.
I like that MSU syndrome. But wait, I want to backtrack for a moment to what you just said, Mark. You just said there's a chapter in your book about the three failures. If I heard you correctly, and say what you said again, I want to make sure I understood what you were saying.
And how I recovered.
Oh, and how one you recovered from those. Covered. Got it.
The challenge is, I'm 61. I was born in the mid-1950s. We grew up in a time in which, as I say, failure was not an option. You didn't fail. If you were a fail, you were a screw up. And we now live in the world where fail often fail fast. And what happens is, and this is true of so many of my generation, we hang on. We say we can make this work. And the answer is, sometimes you have to say very early on, actually always have a plan B. And be willing to cut loose when this is not going to work. Because one of the things I've seen over and over again is when people, particularly coming out of the Great Recession, people, when they stuck it out too long, end up never recovering. And I can give you two examples. I met a woman who decided to start her own business, took out a business loan in 2007. An absolute horrible time to start a business at the end of 2007, and stuck it out all the way to 2012 and finally chucked it in, and she's still paying off the $50,000 loan she still has.
Oh, no.
And she was out of her profession long enough, she's having a horrible time getting back in. Versus I have a good friend who bought a stamping franchise, believe it or not, the end of 2007. Her timing couldn't have been any worse. She decided the summer of 2008 to say this isn't gonna work, and she saved herself a ton of money.
So how do you know though when it's time to cut your losses or invest? I mean, nobody had a crystal ball.
It's a matter of, as you start rolling things out, understanding, being realistic about your income. being realistic about the numbers, measure.
Measure what?
Income, cash flow, outflow. I mean, I've been through two startups. You know, when you have a startup, you're looking, you got so much money invested. What are you gonna, what's your bleed rate for cash, right? And when you start realizing that this ain't going to cut it, you're going to run out of money, you're going to look at saying, okay, what am I going to do? And again, I grew up in the generation that says, I'm sorry, if you give up, you're a screw up. And the reality is, no, understand what it is, what you're doing, measure, and have a plan B. So when I started my business career pivot, I knew what my run rate was for cash. I measured the fact that I measured how fast was my business growing. Was I meeting my income projection, my revenue projections? And I knew if I had, I'll use the example after this last election, my business was off the first half of this last year by 60%.
Wow.
Right? Now, my business is back to the rate it was before the election. But I'm measuring.
Yeah,
and,
I think...
And that's not part of the culture I was raised in.
Yeah, I think somebody once said, if it's not measured, it doesn't exist. And I think that's where we do get into trouble, is that people don't keep track of how much they spend or how much they save or how much they have to invest or not invest in a new company or to a career transition. I think that that's why a lot of Americans that I've come across, and people even internationally where I've traveled, have found that they'll trade jobs, they don't think about it before they make a move, and there's no strategy or long-term planning, and they think, oh, I want to make a career transition, but they didn't actually think the process through and go, okay, here's my mortgage, here's my kids' education, my overhead, do I have that much in the bank so that I have a six-month window? Because oftentimes it could take at least that long, either A, to find a job in a different field, or B, to start a new company. You're not going to see profits typically for at least the first several months.
Well, the other key piece is, don't make stuff up. Actually go get the facts. So when I went off to teach high school math, I just went off and said, you know what? I'm an engineer. I've been teaching people all over the world. I understand adult learning theory. I can learn to teach adolescents. There's a high demand for math teachers. They'll want me. Well, you know what? No, they didn't. They didn't want any guy over 40.
Oh, wow.
They don't want us because we don't do what we're told.
I don't think that's true of everybody, but maybe in some cases.
Well, put it bluntly, you know, things like I joke in my second year of teaching, we have this thing called TAX, or it used to be TAX, Texas Assessment of Knowledge and Skills. And in the fifth week of the first six-week grading period, a district official walked into my classroom and handed me a six-week Algebra 2 test for 6 weeks. It was horrible. And so I looked at him. I said, so what's the penalty if I don't give this? And she gave me this stern look, Mr. Miller, you don't seem to understand. This is mandatory. And I went, no. What's the penalty if I don't get this? And she says, you don't understand. It's mandatory. I said, got it. They walked out of the room. I threw it in the trash.
Oh, no.
Nothing happened.
I know. There's so many things we're afraid of that we think are going to come to pass and they don't. But to all the listeners out there, if your boss gives you something to do, unless you maybe have money in the bank, my advice, I'm going to put a little caveat, little asterisk on this show. As much as your story is inspiring, Mark, I think that a lot of people should still take it with a grain of salt unless they have a good size savings or 401k.
The important point is that wasn't my boss.
Fair.
Okay. And so, but the point is, and schools are managed in very bizarre ways. Believe it or not, my first year, I was mentoring my principal going through high school redesign. I have a ton of funny stories. we were the first school to get a Gates Foundation grant for high school redesign. And I twice at IBM had re-engineered organizations successfully. And I can tell you, I can't make you do anything. and she was just going to say, we're going to tell the teachers what to do, and they're going to go do it. I said, no, they're not. And by the way, every educational initiative has failed for exactly this reason.
But yeah, you need enrollment, not just school enrollment, but you need buy-in from the teachers and the people, the powers that be. And I think that's why most organizations, educational or otherwise, fail.
Yes. No, when I was done teaching, I could give you root cause analysis for every problem in the school, and I couldn't tell you how to fix anything. Because it was deeply rooted in the culture of education. But the fact is you get involved in, you know, I assumed they would want me. And by the way, I got hired at the very last minute when they didn't have anybody else to hire. I got hired those basically a couple days before school started. And they finally said, well, we got to hire someone like Mark. And so I talked, you know, I always say, you've got to go out and test drive this stuff. Similarly, I would be approached by a lot of people like me who would say, I want to do what you're doing, Mark, when I retire. And I would say, who are these people? They were all white, middle class, educated, suburban raised, and knew who the parents were. Where will they get hired? Large urban school districts with minority-majority populations, poverty, and single-parent households. And they say, well, I'll go get a job at a suburban school district. I say, you can't. They don't want you. and they have such low turnover that you're never going to get a job. You are going to get a job at one of these school districts. And I used to joke the fact that, you know, I got in there after 6 weeks. I realized, Toto, I'm not in Kansas anymore. I did not.
It puts things in perspective, that's for sure.
It put things in perspective. And I always tell people, if you're going to go do it, you've got to do it for the right reasons. Now, I had tremendous impact on a lot of kids. But it was different than I expected.
So
it's going out and actually talking to people and make sure doing the homework. Sometimes it's test driving. Sometimes it's just simply, no matter what kind of transition you make, do it from the facts and not what you make up in your head.
What if somebody doesn't even know where to start? Like, for example, teaching seems like a relatively simple transition for the purposes of an example, because there are lots of teachers out there. You could go out and ask people, find out very clearly what you need to become a teacher. But let's say somebody out there wants to do something completely obtuse or out there, like being a theater director or something that they've never done before or something that's not as accessible to the general public. How would you even begin to get the facts or strategize to go into a career realm that you've never dealt with before or have no working knowledge of?
Well, that's where you go get out and start finding the people who are doing what you want to do and how did they get there. And by the way, you can get on LinkedIn and find those people. Now,
great advice.
One of the key pieces is I always claim is find people who look, taste, and smell like you. and that will give you a lot of hints as to what is possible. So I'll give you a really far end example. I had a gentleman who came to me, and he had a PhD in linguistics. And he had spent the last 20 years in Africa translating Bibles into obscure languages.
Wow.
Okay. And very, very, very mission driven. You know, in other words, that translation of Bibles was very important to him. It fed his soul. And so he ended up coming back to the U.S. with his family because of health issues within the family. And he's going, what do I do now? I said, well, what I would probably do and he's probably around 40, is I would search on everyone who attended one of the top 10 linguistic programs with PhDs in 5 years before and after you graduated. So they're roughly within the same age range. And search on things like religion, theology, either, you know, find the keywords that make sense. And find the people who look, taste, and smell like him and going, what the heck are they doing?
Yeah, great advice. I tell a lot of job seekers nowadays, it's so different than it was even 10 or 20 years ago, where you can actually research your competition and look at the career trajectory of different people who are out there. And like you said, use keywords, look up the school, look up, you know, linguistics or religion. Do a Boolean search on LinkedIn, and then next thing you know, you can see what people have, the jobs that you want to have, what companies hire people with your skill sets. And I think it's a very valuable piece of advice for anybody, even if you're just starting off your career, even if you're not pivoting or transitioning and you're looking for your first job. I think that so many of us as human beings, what you said earlier, we don't check the facts and we don't actually do our due diligence. We get this fairy dust mentality of, oh, this sounds like a good idea, but we don't do our due diligence. And then we wind up miserable in jobs for 6 months, 6 years, or 50 years, or however long it might be. And then we regret not having done better research in the first place. So I think that's a great piece of advice for anybody out there who's thinking of either landing their first job or transitioning to a new field.
Well, I want you to think about yourself as a consultant. You solve problems for your employer. Okay, what are those problems? Okay, then what employers have those problems? Now you have a list of companies that are capable of hiring you. Now, do you ever know when a job will open up? And the answer is you never know. You never know what company is growing, what company is kind of about ready to hire, you know, in 3 months. You don't know who they're going to fire and they're going to need to replace. You don't know any of that. So I just had Gary O'Neill on my podcast. He's on the 18th it comes out. And Gary recruits for Austin HR, which is an outsourced recruiting company for about 150 startups here in Austin. And I had him talk about how he is a recruiter. How would he go looking for a job? And he basically says, I would look for 200 companies that are capable of hiring me. And then I would reach out to three people at each company, a recruiter, a peer, and a hiring manager, and reach out and say, by the way, these are the problems I solve. Can we have a discussion? And, you know, he says in recruiting, they have to touch 170 plus people for every hire they make. He says, well, okay, I'm going to reach out to 600 people. I'm going to do 200 per company. You know, I want to get 200 companies, three of each. I'm going to reach out to 600 people. And I'm just going to reach out. And the idea is people hire people.
Until AI gets involved.
yes. And by the way, there are some consulting firms that are doing some of that.
But I'm saying for the time being, yes, people do still hire people hypothetically.
but what you want to do is you want to get past all of this applicant tracking system, all this stuff, because as Gary was saying, there are no rules.
Yeah, at the end of the day, somebody's going to have to approve the paperwork and stamp. And if you know who that person is, then that's how you can get your foot in the door.
That's right. And all, you know, it's all he talked about was, how do I get someone to talk to me? And it's all about solving the employer's problems. It's not about selling yourself. It's about understanding what the employer's problem is. Because until you know that, you can't position yourself. Again, don't make stuff up.
MSU. I love that. Well, Mark, right? I could talk to you all day. You have so much great advice to share. And I do want to be sure that A, our listeners know where to find you and where to find information on Career Pivot. And B, I would love to know, what are the three takeaways that you would love our listeners to have today from our conversation?
Sure. The three takeaways is, number one, know thyself. You need to, when you start looking at making a transition, you got to know who you are. So, and again, this is not, you heard me talk about MSU. two, you want to work from facts. Okay. Go do your homework. And three, your next job is going to come from a relationship. In other words, you are not going to do this alone. And by the way, this is really hard. I've got a number of 60-year-old plus clients who, damn, they want to do it the old way. And the rules are a certain way, and there are no rules. And by the way, the hiring process today in most companies is pretty broken.
That's true.
So go make the rules.
I think that's great advice, is just don't make things up. Go out there, do your research, make sure that you're clear on the problems that you solve. And like you said, you can't do it alone. I think that we all are ships into ourselves. And having just returned from Nepal, I was mentioning this to somebody else, as we were physically building the school with no foreman, no project manager, and people speaking different tribal languages plus English, all of a sudden we started to pour the sand into the foundation of the school. And with nothing else, all of a sudden two lines of people formed, one on one side, one on the other, all ages, all genders, it didn't matter. And one side was carrying the sand in, the other side was handing the bowls back. But it was just teamwork. And that was just intrinsically, as a culture, they were designed for teamwork. And I think that in our culture, it's something that we just aren't trained for, at least in the United States. We're trained for me first, as opposed to one of my friends in Japan was just saying, it's completely different in Japan or in China or in other parts of the world. It's you're part of the whole and not an individual. And the more that we can embrace the camaraderie and the sense of community and helping pay it forward and helping one another, I think the greater success we'll have, not only individually, but as a culture.
And by the way, when you put the emphasis on the other side, you are more likable.
True.
And people hire people they like. Okay? No. It's that simple. And so, in fact, I just had a blog post I updated this last week on asking probing questions. Learning how to impress people by asking really good questions. And by the way, introverted people can do this better than anybody else.
Because they're curious.
Because they're curious, and by the way, they're better listeners.
So true. So okay. True, unfortunately, but true.
Right, very true.
I say unfortunately as kind of a quasi-extrovert introvert, but I say that because I know I have lessons to learn in listening myself. So that's why I say unfortunately.
Well, I call myself a closet introvert. You would never know by meeting me that I'm an introvert. But I spent 10 years doing nothing but presenting for IBM. I was a geek that could speak, or a articulate techno weenie, which we know is an oxymoron. And I am not who I appear to be. But if people want to get a hold of me, they can go to careerpivot.com, and there's a contact me button on there. I am Mr. Miller or Mr. Miller on LinkedIn. And I am, you'll find Career Pivot on Twitter. You'll find my book, Repurpose Your Career, A Practical Guide for the Second Half of Life, on Amazon. And hopefully by the time this airs, I will be, the files have been submitted for my second audiobook. Repurpose Your Career audiobook will be out, I'm hoping, the next couple of weeks.
Oh, fantastic. Well, speaking of which, people can find the show immediately following the pod, or immediately following the show on LA Talk Radio's website. So it will be available immediately after the show for download on LA Talk Radio under Get Yourself the Job, or in about by the end of the week, typically at the latest. It will also be available for download as well on iTunes under Get Yourself the Job on iTunes. And Mark, I'm so happy we've had you on today to talk about career pivot, and I think you've offered some wonderful tips and tricks to get out there and to find the way to your next job. And obviously, please keep Mark in mind if you're looking to pivot your career yourself. I'm sure Mark would be a great resource for you. And we do invite you to tune in next week to join us with Andy Simon. Dr. Andy Simon is a corporate anthropologist, and we're going to be discussing corporate anthropology in the workplace and how it impacts you. So thanks so much for joining us today, Mark. Happy holidays to everybody out there, and tune in again next week, Monday at 4. Thanks so much.
You're listening to Get Yourself the Job with Jennifer Hill, only on LA Talk Radio.